This week we look at the elections of 1860 and 1864 and President Abraham Lincoln. Our guest is historian Matthew Pinsker, the author of the forthcoming book, The Race of Ambition, Abraham Lincoln and the Pursuit of Power, 1832 to 1864. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi.
The popular perception of Lincoln is that he was an unknown, sort of inexperienced candidate for the American presidency, and he really wasn't even the Republican Party's first choice. Is this true?
Well, there's some basis for that, but it can be misleading. Lincoln was someone who had been in politics for nearly 30 years by that point, and he was very prominent in Illinois. And he was also well-known to party insiders across the country. He had nearly been the Republican Party's first vice presidential nominee in 1856. And the truth is that he worked very hard in the year and a half before the nomination to increase his name recognition. He spoke in half of the free states in the North and had the Lincoln-Douglas debates published just before the nominating conventions. So he was effectively well-known and especially prominent in a state that was absolutely necessary for a Republican victory in 1860.
Was he the first choice at the convention?
Well, he was the first choice of the host delegation, the Illinois delegation, and then he pursued a very effective second choice strategy among the other delegations. So even though he wasn't the front runner, I think anybody who was shrewd at the time would have recognized that he had a decent shot from the very beginning. Yeah.
Who was the first runner, the front runner, to your way of thinking?
Well, I think anybody would concede that Senator William Seward from New York was the front runner. But being the front runner, he was also the leading target. And he was a divisive figure to some factions of the party, and even had enemies within his own state delegation who were working against him at the convention.
That was due to his position on slavery?
Well, actually, in some ways, it was due more to his position on nativism, or the integration of immigrants into American society, which during the 1850s was an equally prominent issue across the North.
Okay. Well, I'll come back to that in a moment, but we picked the election of 1860 because for most people, it is the election that decided the fate of the Union. Do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely.
And how would you defend that?
Well, this is a period of time when the American experiment in democracy is still somewhat in question. And it's the first election where the losers refuse to accept the results. And so secession raises the question of whether or not democracy can work or it would degenerate into anarchy whenever the contest became too divisive. And so actually both elections, 1860 and 1864, taken together, confirm, I think, the fundamental quality that elections represent in our system.
Okay. Well, you told us how the Republicans arrived at their candidate. What about the Democrats?
Well, in those days, the Democrats had what was called the two-thirds rule, which required a nominee of their party to receive two-thirds of the delegates' votes before he could be nominated, which was a high threshold that often, you know, left them frustrated for hundreds of ballots in some cases before they could find a candidate who could achieve that kind of supermajority. And they had a leading candidate in 1860 who was also from Illinois, Stephen Douglas, a senator. But he was a divisive figure in many ways because of his personality and also his positions. And he had been feuding with the incumbent Democratic president, James Buchanan. So when the Democrats met in April in 1860 in Charleston, South Carolina, they were unable to reach a two-thirds majority to nominate Douglas. And because of other reasons related to the platform, Southern delegates walked out of the convention. And ultimately, the Southern Democrats formed their own organization for this election, and they nominated Buchanan's vice president, John Breckinridge, from Kentucky, as their candidate. And finally, the Northern Democrats reorganized in June and nominated Douglas. So the split in the Democratic Party actually foreshadowed the split in the Union.
Okay, so that gives us three candidates, Lincoln, Douglas, and Breckinridge. Yet there was a fourth. Who was he, and where did he come from?
The fourth candidate was John Bell of the Constitutional Union Party, which came together only for this election. And they were mostly former Whigs or former nativists, know-nothings, who the others considered old fogies, but they considered themselves to be nationalists in the tradition of a Henry Clay or a Daniel Webster. And they were mostly popular, or at least had their strongest support in the border states of the Upper South.
Okay, looking at the election itself, perhaps our listeners would like to hear about the campaigning. Let's take Lincoln's, for example. How would you assess Lincoln's campaign, and how would it compare to today?
Well, they were strange campaigns by our standards in presidential contests in those days, because candidates were expected not to be involved themselves in the race. So Lincoln gave no public speeches and was not active, at least outwardly, in the race. But there was widespread popular participation. The Republicans had what they called wide-awake clubs, which were groups of young men almost in paramilitary units who sponsored torchlight parades and had what Lincoln used to call monster meetings. And the Democrats, because of their split, were unable to generate the same kind of sort of organized enthusiasm. And that's what led one of their candidates, Stephen Douglas, to break tradition and actively campaign himself. And this is one of the first instances we have of a presidential candidate, you know, taking his case to the people directly.
Well, tell us what happened then. We know Lincoln won, but we have four candidates. It must have been a peculiar election.
Yeah, it was a peculiar race in several ways. First of all, it's a four-candidate race, but really it was a two-candidate race in two different ways. The contest in the South was essentially between just Bell and Breckinridge, and the contest in the North was essentially just between Douglas and Lincoln. And in the South, the issue was really slavery, with each side warning about potential secession if the Republicans won and what that would mean and how Southerners could deal with that. But in the Northern contest, the issues were sometimes more local and involved questions about the Homestead Act or the Pacific Railroad or the tariff, as well as slavery. And what's interesting about this election, even though it was charged with so much moral weight and it was incredibly contested over significant issues, people still complain then just like they do today. Frederick Douglass, the great black orator, wrote in a letter that there were four parties and no principles in that contest. There were also no public opinion polls then, obviously, but there were state elections that were held prior to the presidential contest in November. So early results from state contests in October hinted at the eventual outcome. And it hinted that Lincoln would win because the Republicans seemed to have a clear majority in the North, where they had enough electoral votes to control the ultimate decision.
And did it come to pass that Lincoln was a sectional victor?
Yes. I mean, the Republicans did not even have a ticket in 10 of the southern states. Lincoln won ultimately with just under 40% of the popular vote, but he actually won 54% of the popular vote in the North and won all of the free states except for part of New Jersey. Now, his opponents outpolled him, if you combine their votes, by over a million popular votes. But even with that huge advantage in the popular race, because of Lincoln's strength in the North, he would have won the Electoral College anyway, even if there were only... even if there was only one opponent.
So Lincoln wins, he's elected, the South secedes, we end up in a civil war, and then after 3 years of war that isn't particularly strong for the Union, Lincoln faces re-election. How did he do in re-election in 1864?
Well, the first thing to point out, I think, and this is a factor that it would be easy to overlook today, was that there was no general expectation that a candidate that an incumbent president would run for re-election. In fact, no president had been re-elected in over 30 years, not since Andrew Jackson in 1832. And actually, Lincoln came from an anti-Jackson tradition, which had always supported the idea of rotation in office. So it was not a surefire thing that he would run. And frankly, the Republicans, like you said, had been suffering from some frustration with the war effort, and they had suffered setbacks in the 1862 elections. But the victories in 1863 at places like Gettysburg and Vicksburg, and the collapse of the Democratic opposition in key state elections in 1863 led to a kind of re-energized support for the Lincoln administration. And the truth is that Lincoln's previous rivals were not very effective in outpacing him. Seward, who had been the leader in 1860, was now a loyal Secretary of State in the Lincoln cabinet and supported the president. And Salmon Chase, who had been one of the other leading rivals for the nomination in 1860, was now Secretary of Treasury. And although he tried to win the nomination in 1864, he wasn't very adept at the local politics, and Lincoln's grassroots support just overwhelmed him.
Hmm. Now, the Democratic opposition runs John McClellan, former Union general. What was his platform, and what threat did he pose to Lincoln?
Well, the Democrats nominate General George McClellan in August of 1864, who is a pro-war candidate, a Democrat who supports the war effort. But they nominate him on a platform that blames the Lincoln administration and calls the war a failure. So the split within the Democratic Party was actually very destructive for their chances. And adding to that, of course, was the fact that just after their convention, the Union finally seems to break through, and General Sherman succeeds in taking Atlanta in early September, which changes the sense of momentum to the war and seems to indicate that the war effort is finally coming to its close. So Lincoln seems then at that point to have secured re-election. But the truth is the voting patterns are relatively stable. He won 54% of the vote in 1860. He won 55% of the vote in 1864. Actually, what I mean is he won 54% of the popular vote in the North in 1860. And in 1864, with Southern states not participating, he won 55% of the popular vote.
Okay.
So you see there's a sort of stable element to the voting pattern.
Right, right. Sorry on that misspeak. It was George McClellan, sure. Tell us about, then, the qualities that Lincoln brought to the presidency. He's seen largely as one of the best presidents of all time. What made him so great?
Well, you can look at three central acts. He saved the Union, or helped to. He emancipated the slaves, or helped to. And he confirmed the centrality of elections in our system. And that third element is sometimes overlooked, but it's so critically important. You remember during the Civil War, Lincoln agreed to the suspension of habeas corpus, and his administration arrested over 15,000 people for political reasons. But he never considered suspending the elections for president in 1864. And for me, that's a signal victory for the cause of democracy, and one that owes a great deal to his confidence in his abilities to both manage the war and run for re-election at the same time. And then there are all of his other qualities, his incredible eloquence, his effective deal-making skills, and his personal qualities.
Expand a bit on his personal qualities. What do you think were so important there?
Well, this is a matter of debate among some scholars, but I think what people sometimes overlook is that Lincoln was a pragmatist in that he was able to work with a variety of people and to compromise. But the key to deal-making in politics, as anyone knows, is the ability to inspire some respect from your opponents, either out of fear for your stubbornness, that you stick to your principles, or out of fear for your support outside the room. And Lincoln cultivated support outside of Capitol Hill, among governors, among soldiers, among the public, and he was surprisingly stubborn about his positions once he settled on them. And that made him a very effective dealmaker. And so I think his stubbornness and patience was a key element to his success as a sort of political manipulator, and sometimes overlooked when people emphasize his pragmatism.
Well, given that answer, I think I know what your answer to the next question is going to be, but which camp do you fall in? There are some who think that Lincoln's elevation to his high position now in history was due to his having been assassinated. Others say, no, he really was that great. Where do you come down in that debate?
Well, I think it's almost indisputable that his actions as president and the quality of his speeches and public documents would stand the test of time with or without an assassination. But The truth is that from the beginning of his life to the end of his life, with that assassination on Good Friday in 1865, you have a drama that is unparalleled in American history. And that drama, I think, fueled some of the almost religious affection for Lincoln, and certainly a lot of the attention over the years devoted to him. His place as a great president is irrelevant to the assassination, but his, you know, mythical status as an icon is probably at least partly a result of the way that assassination happened.
And that mythical status was then pretty much immediate.
Correct. Okay. And, you know, it's interesting that as historians, the assassination also creates another opportunity. His law partner, William Herndon, set about almost immediately after Lincoln's death collecting interviews and records about Lincoln's life to try to, in his view, puncture the apotheosis, this myth that had developed, because he believed it was unfair to Lincoln's true self. And that created, in effect, the largest historical record we have of any American figure from that era. And if he had not died then, I'm sure those interviews and those records would have been lost to time.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to leave it at that. We're out of time. So thank you, Matthew, for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Matthew Pinsker, author of the forthcoming book, The Race of Ambition, Abraham Lincoln and the Pursuit of Power, 1832 to 1864.